Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and as usual, we are live, largely through the faithfulness of a man named Dave, who I've never met, who is at KPDQ Studios, iced in, snowed in, engineering the program. Our regular engineers couldn't make it because all the roads are icy in Portland, Oregon right now. There's a terrible storm there, but Dave happened to be camped out there in the studio, so he's stuck there, but he's able to do the show for us today, so my appreciation, shout out to Dave for that. Apart from that, our program will proceed, I hope, as usual, as long as the electricity in Portland stays flowing, and we'll do what we always do, and that is take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith. And by the way, I'm in Southern California. There's no snow or ice here. I'm in good shape, but we do have our hub of our broadcast out of Portland, which I patch into Portland through an internet connection. So I'm in very different circumstances than the man you'll talk to when you call. He's the call screener today. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737, and we'll take your calls if you have questions about the Bible, about the Christian faith, or you want to disagree with the host about something. Feel free to do so. All right, and we're going to talk first of all to Sammy in Dallas, Texas. Sammy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I want to ask a question that you've probably answered maybe a few times before, but it's regarding Jephthah, the judge who sacrificed his daughter. And I've heard three, I guess, interpretations of the sacrifice, that it was an actual burnt offering with her, and also that it was offering her to the temple for her services, a lifetime of service. And the third one was also that it was her virginity that was given to the priest of the time, and that's why that she bemoaned her virginity when she went into the mountainside. So those are the three that I've heard, and I was just getting your opinion on which one is the most valid. Which one do you think is valid, or is there even more interpretations?
Right. Well, obviously many of our listeners have no idea what the background of this question is. In the book of Judges, in chapter 11, one of the leaders of Israel, one of the military leaders of Israel, was a man named Jephthah, and he had a daughter, and only one daughter. He didn't have any sons, so his entire future legacy rested in this daughter and any children that she might have in the future. But while he was in battle against the Ammonites, he made a vow to the Lord, and here's what he said. He said to the Lord, "If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me, will I when I return in peace from the people of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." That's Judges verses 30 and 31. Now, when he did come home safely and victoriously from his battle against the Ammonites, the first thing that came out of his house was his daughter, which he had promised to be the Lord's and to offer up as a burnt offering. Now, of course, the idea of offering human sacrifice would be strictly forbidden in the law of Moses. But on the other hand, in the period of the judges, the law of Moses was often poorly preserved among the people, and they often didn't follow it very well, as the book of Judges attests to. So, I mean, it may be that maybe he did offer his daughter as a sacrifice. But what we see is that when she herself became resigned to whatever it was her father was going to do, it says in verse 37, she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months, that I may go and wander in the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends and I." So he said, "Go." And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her friends and bewailed her virginity on the mountains. And it was so, at the end of the 2 months, that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed. She knew no man. And it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Now, it's interesting because the only thing that would suggest that she was sacrificed as a burnt offering, is the fact that the wording of his vow was that whatever comes out to meet him shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. Now, there could have been a subtext here that obviously you can't offer up to the Lord as a burnt offering certain things. What if a donkey came out, or a dog, or a human? Obviously, to offer any such things, at the altar would be absolutely forbidden in the Jewish law, which means that if he was not unaware of that, I think he would be aware of that, his vow would have meant something like this: whatever comes out to me, I'm going to dedicate it to the Lord. And we could say, in parenthesis, if possible, I will offer it as a burnt offering to the Lord. Which means if it was a lamb or a goat or an ox or something like that, then he would offer it as a burnt offering. If it was something which could not be offered as a burnt offering, like a dog or a pig, probably wouldn't be a pig because they wouldn't have those, but they'd have dogs and donkeys and camels and humans, all of those would be unclean and would not be offered. I think his vow must have had that subtext. Now, it may not have, but it may have. In other words, he's saying, I'm going to dedicate whatever comes out to meet me to the Lord, period. And if it's possible and appropriate, I will offer it as a burnt offering to the Lord. That's what I think his vow meant. And it would seem to be confirmed by the fact that the girl does not go out with her friends to mourn her death, but her perpetual virginity. Because as her fate was, it says she knew no man. That is, she remained a virgin all her life. Just as Samuel was dedicated to the Lord by his mother, Hannah, and that meant he served the Lord in the tabernacle from his childhood on and served the Lord all his life, though he was not sacrificed to the Lord. So I think Jephthah's daughter was probably treated in that way, too. He dedicated her to the Lord. She probably had to be a perpetual virgin, could not marry because she now belonged to the service of the tabernacle and served the Lord there the rest of her life. That meant, of course, that Jephthah would have no grandchildren because his daughter was not going to be married. Therefore, his name was going to end at that point. And that's why it was such a grief to him. And what the daughters of Jephthah, or what the daughters of Gilead did for years afterwards is mourn for her virginity, not mourn for her death. And so, in my opinion, she was simply dedicated to the Lord as a servant to the tabernacle by her father. And she was not offered as a sacrifice, which would have been an atrocity. And not that there weren't atrocities that were actually committed during the period of the judges. There certainly were, as there were at every other time in Israel's history. But I don't think that Jephthah's vow would have implied that he would literally sacrifice anything that came out, since so many things could not be legitimately even considered as sacrifices, including humans. So I think that his first statement, whatever comes out and meets me first, will be the Lord's. That's the absolute. He, if it can be sacrificed, it will be sacrificed. If it can't be, it'll still be the Lord's. It'll be dedicated to the Lord. And I think that's what happened with his daughter. That is how I would understand that story.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. I imagine that if he did something like that, that was so bad, he wouldn't have been mentioned as a, someone of faith or anything like that. But
He is mentioned in Hebrews 11 as one of the great men of faith, but then so is Samson, and he did some pretty bad things, too.
Right. That's true.
And so is David, and he did some bad things, too. But you see, nobody's perfect. And almost everybody does some really bad things in their lifetime. But, of course, we're justified by faith, not by the magnitude of our sins. But of course, if we die without faith, then our sins do count against us. But he and Samson and David, all who did atrocious things, were justified by faith. But that would not necessarily mean he didn't do something really bad. But I just don't see the story being told as if that's what happened. I don't think it's not told in the way you'd expect it to be told if he actually offered a sacrifice of his daughter. Because by letting her go off for a couple of weeks to mourn or whatever it is, I would consider she'd be a flight risk, if she was coming back to be sacrificed,
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I appreciate your answer, and have a good Christmas as well.
Same to you, Sammy. Thanks for your call. All right. We're going to talk next to Jeff from Phoenix, Arizona. We have some lines open for you. This is a perhaps going to be a slow day. Christmas is coming. We will not have a show the day after Christmas, Monday, because the studio will be closed. And therefore, the next 3 days, we will not have a live show. So if you want to get in before then, call now. Or for 3 days, hold your peace. The number again is 844-484-5737. This is a good time to get through. 844-484-5737. So, Jeff from Phoenix, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Nice to talk to you again. Thank you.
Sure.
So on Fox News about a week ago, I saw that a school district or a school in Virginia, and I believe it was a junior high or an elementary school, was allowing a Satan club, the local Satan club, to come in and set up. What do you think of that? And it was a public school.
Right. Well, of course, I have no sympathy for a Satan club at all. The question would be one of legality, because a secular school is not a Christian institution. Already the public schools teach many, many things that Christians would find obnoxious and offensive. And if they even had a course led by a Satanist, it would be slightly worse than what's already going on. But frankly, if we're going to protest the Satan Club at the school, then we've got a long list of things I think we can protest at the public schools. I think we should protest the public schools by pulling our kids out of them. I don't believe that the public schools have our children's well-being at heart. I think that they have an agenda for them, and that any parent who can do something else but out of preference leaves their kid in the public school is taking a tremendous risk with their children's souls. And the fact that the Constitution does not forbid any religion from being expressed in the United States, and that the public schools are taking advantage of that by allowing Satanists to do so, would be another indication that public schools are not the place for children whose parents want to keep them safe spiritually. So that'd be my position. Now, of course, some's going to say, well, not everyone can pull their kids out. Well, what are the different options? Well, one, of course, is a private school. Those usually cost a lot of money, and clearly a lot of people, and single moms would be probably the most vulnerable in this, who they generally don't have a lot of money and they can't stay home and homeschool their kids. I think homeschooling is very probably that first, and private schooling second, the best option for kids. But if they can't do that, then I guess you'd have to do with your kids what you have to do with them and pray for God to protect them. You can certainly tell them to stay far from the Satanist club. I went to public schools when I was a kid. I was a Christian from a Christian family, and they taught things at our school that Christians don't believe in, and yet my parents had taught me what Christians do believe, and I was not vulnerable to the false teaching of the school. But I do think this very thing, it's very hard for a child who's not a very strong believer to resist peer pressure and to not go along with some of the evil influences of the school. And I think for that reason, every church should have a fund, should either be running a Christian school where parents who are in need can have their children go for free, or they should have a service where they have qualified teachers, Christian teachers in the church, who can visit homes and homeschool people's kids while the mother has to go to work. Or they should have a fund where they can give it to, poor people so that they can put their kids in a private school. I mean, there's a variety of things that can be done if the church is have an interest in it. I don't think the churches have, for the most part, seen the need to evacuate the children of the church from the public schools up until this time, and I'm not sure they do now, though they certainly should. It should be obvious that they should. Churches that don't have a concern for the next generation of the Christian population are certainly churches that are run by foolish people, and probably anyone who goes to a church that foolish should probably look for a church that's run by wise people. And wise people will be looking out for the next generation and protecting innocent children from the indoctrination of the Satanists and of the secularists. And that should mean that one of the primary budget items of every church should be providing educational options for the children of the poor, maybe single mothers and others who cannot afford but to put their kids in public school. This, if this is not a priority in a church, that church is asleep. And if you can't wake them up, I think a Christian should find another place to go. Thank you, Jeff. All right, we're going to talk next. Diane from Windham, Maine. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm trying to understand when Mary and Joseph had baby Jesus in Bethlehem, and then 40 days later went to Jerusalem for the dedication, and it says then they went back to Nazareth. But the wise men came to Bethlehem and saw a baby who was a child, not an infant, and they went from Egypt to Egypt from Bethlehem. Is there
Well, what you're doing, your phone is breaking up. But what you're doing is assuming that Luke has given us all the available details we have about the birth stories of Jesus. He does describe, those 40 days after after Jesus was born, he had these purification rites and so forth, and then it says in verse 39 of Luke 2. So when they had performed all these things according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee, to their own city, Nazareth. Now, the truth is they didn't do it immediately. He's simply saying after they'd done this, the next thing I'm going to relate is them going back to Galilee, which they did. Now, there's a gap there between that 40 days and their return to Galilee. And we know that because we have another account in Matthew, which tells us that apparently after those 40 days, after they dedicated their son in the temple, they remained in Bethlehem until the wise men came, which could have been as much as 2 years later. And after the wise men left, of course, they fled to Egypt until Herod was dead. Then they came back, and according to Matthew, when they came back from Egypt, they made the journey then, they relocated then to Nazareth. So both Luke and Matthew agree that when Jesus was a child, his parents relocated from where he was born to Nazareth, and that's where he grew up. What isn't told is that Luke doesn't tell us about the wise men, doesn't tell us about the trip to Egypt, and interestingly, Luke doesn't tell us about the wise men, Luke tells us some of the story, and Matthew tells us the other part of the story, but it's not hard to harmonize unless you assume that in Luke 2, verse 39. That it, when it says, so when they had performed all things according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee. If we assume that means as soon as they had done it, they turned on their heels and went to Galilee, well, then that would be in conflict with what we know from the other information. And, when you look at the four Gospels, they do supplement each other. They, none of them tells the whole story. Several of them tell many of the same details, but each gospel has its own part of the story that it includes, which the others leave out. And in this case, Matthew has included that information about the wise men and the trip to Egypt, which Luke has omitted and has not mentioned. But then Luke goes on and talks about when Jesus was 12 years old, and Matthew doesn't tell us anything about that, nor does Mark.
Right.
Or John. Yeah.
And Zechariah and Mary lived in Jerusalem, I would imagine, and they stayed in Jerusalem, or is that not necessarily true? He just was in Jerusalem for the dedication, for the time that he was serving in the temple.
Zechariah didn't live in Bethlehem. Zechariah was living in a Levitical city, in all likelihood, and let me see where it says when Mary went to visit Elizabeth and Zechariah in Luke 1:39, it says Mary arose in those days and went to the hill country with haste to a city of Judah and entered the house of Zechariah.
Okay.
So in the hill country of Judah, one of the cities there is where Zechariah and Elizabeth lived. They were related to Mary and Joseph. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thank you for helping me understand how to reconcile those differences. I appreciate that. Have a Merry Christmas.
Hey, you too, Diane. And remember, when you're reading the Gospels, none of the Gospels are seeking to give you the comprehensive story. Each of them are giving us various details of the story that they think should be included, and leaving out many. In fact, Mark and John leave out the birth of Jesus altogether. They never even mention the birth of Jesus. So, you know, Luke and Matthew have birth stories, but Luke's birth story and Matthew's supplement each other rather than duplicate each other. They didn't see any need to duplicate each other, I assume. Don't need to reinvent the wheel if it's not broken. They don't have to fix it. Okay, so Danny in McCall, Idaho is next. Hi, Danny.
Hi. I was wondering about the Arc of Triomphe in France. I know Napoleon had some kind of thing going on with that, but I heard a long time ago on a show that in 70 AD, the Romans or somebody had some of the artifacts from the temple in Jerusalem after the temple got destroyed in 70 AD, and they took and paraded through the Arc de Triomphe with those artifacts. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
I don't. Actually, I don't think the Ark was in the temple in 70 AD when it was destroyed, so I don't think the Romans took the Ark.
Not the Ark, but some artifacts from...
Well, maybe some of them, yeah.
From the temple, that they had some kind of parade or something to...
Okay, so are you talking about the Arch of Triumph, Titus's Arch of Triumph in Rome?
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe that was it. I'm not really sure.
Okay, well, yes. I mean, this is customary when Romans would conquer some enemy. The general who led the campaign would come back usually with captives from the war and with trophies from the war. And as he returned to Rome, they would set up an arch of triumph and have a parade.
Okay, that's what it was.
Yes, yeah. And they would honor that general, and he would march with some of his troops, I'm sure, and with his captives and with his trophies of the war through the streets of Rome as a celebration of that victory. And there is an Arch of Titus, I believe, in Rome that was apparently his to celebrate his victory over Jerusalem. We can assume. I don't know if we have exact records about this, but just given the customs of the Romans, it's almost certain that he would have brought back with him captives from Jerusalem and treasures from the temple and so forth.
Okay, I didn't know it was the Arch of Titus. I thought it was the Arch de Triomphe in France. So.
Well, I don't know which. I don't know anything about an Arch of Triomphe in France. Triumph is means victory.
Uh-huh.
And so they typically had arches of victory for their victory parades in Rome.
Okay.
I don't know of anything in France, but there may be something there too. I'm not aware of it.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for your call. Okay. Let's see here. We're going to talk to Mary from Nashville, Tennessee. Mary, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi there. Hey, I've been to France, and there is a L'Arc de Triomphe.
Okay.
I think it was built by Napoleon, and then for his conquering, and then I think Hitler used it when they stormed Paris.
Okay,
anyway,
so that'd be different than what happened in 70 AD. Yeah. Okay, go on.
Yeah, very different. Anyway, have you heard of or know anything about something called the Book of Yahweh, put out by the House of Yahweh? I know someone who started reading it. And they say it's the only Bible that is accurate or counts or whatever. And so I don't know anything about it and thought you might.
I do not recall ever encountering that book or the people who published it. If anyone says that they have a book that most of us don't have, which is the only authentic Bible, then they are it's certainly a great marketing gimmick. Actually, the Bible that you and I can purchase, in any of the English translations we have, are translated as best as the translators know how from Greek and Hebrew manuscripts, which are the very best manuscripts known. I mean, it's not as if someone else from a little group called House of Yahweh has discovered new manuscripts, or they are superior Greek and Hebrew scholars and translate them better. It sounds to me like it may be a group that wants to preserve the name Yahweh in the scriptures, which for
yeah,
some reason...
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of Hebrew roots in there.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like it, yeah. Yeah. It's true that most English translations do not preserve the name Yahweh, although that was used in the Hebrew Bible. But most English translations translate Yahweh as Lord, and they do that because they're following the Jewish tradition, which was 3 centuries before Christ, when the Septuagint translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek. They chose the word Lord, or Kyrios, to replace the name Yahweh. I don't know why they did, but apparently that didn't offend God, because Jesus and the apostles all quoted from the Septuagint, and including using the word Kyrios to replace Yahweh. So, you know, whoever's saying otherwise, they just have a different way of looking at it than the apostles and Jesus. Jesus and the apostles apparently never used the word Yahweh, at least not in the writings. And they used a Bible that didn't use that word. I'm out of time for this half hour. We have another half hour coming. Don't go away. The Narrow Path is listener supported. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and see how to support us, or just take free stuff. Thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share the narrow path with Steve Gregg, with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com, where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you are interested in asking a question about the Bible or the Christian faith, or expressing a difference of opinion that you have with the host, feel free to give me a call. We have a half hour. We have a couple of lines open right now. You can, one of them's taken. Apparently one line open right now. You can call this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Cesar from Burbank, California. Hi, Cesar. Welcome.
Hi, brother. Thank you for taking my call. Uh-huh. So my question is, do you think a brother in Christ would be able to perform a marriage ceremony even though he's not ordained, or there would be no certificate obtained?
Well, there's actually nothing in the Bible that says that marriages have to be performed by an ordained minister. There are people who are ordained as elders in the church, and some who are ordained as deacons in the Bible, but they're not said to have the duties of performing marriages. In the second century, one of the bishops named Ignatius had come up with the idea, or someone came up with the idea, and he repeated it, that there should be no marriages performed, nor for that matter, no communion performed or any church meetings performed without the bishop present. He didn't say the bishop had to do the wedding ceremony, though. But even so, he's going beyond Scripture. The Bible doesn't say who has to be present or who has to perform the ceremony. The main thing in the Bible is that marriages were arranged between families. The bride's family and the groom's family agree to it, and vows of some kind were taken that were witnessed by the family. And of course, I'm sure that in later Christian history, you know, Christians being involved as witnesses besides the family would be the norm. So there's really nothing in the Bible that talks about who can officiate at a wedding and who cannot. Now, obviously, if a person is not an ordained minister, then anything he says or does at a wedding ceremony will not be recognized by the state. But the Bible doesn't say that marriages have to be recognized by the state. In fact, there's nothing in the Bible that suggests that they should be. But, I mean, not that it's wrong for the state to recognize them, but there's nothing in the Bible that makes that mandatory. So I don't see any reason why any Christian brother could not perform a marriage ceremony, but if they want the ceremony to be, recognized by the state as a legal contract, they would have to get somebody, maybe a judge or someone, to sign off on the on their certificate or whatever.
Got it. Got it. Okay. Thank you, brother.
All right. Thank you for your call. God bless you, too. Our next caller is Nigel in Edmonds, Washington. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Nigel. Well, I think I've got his line activated. That sounds like a silent line to me. Nigel, if you're there, I can't hear you. I'm going to have to hang up. Call back. You may get a line that I can hear. I don't know why I can't hear you there, but we obviously can't have a radio broadcast where we're talking to silence. I'm not saying it's your fault, but try again. The number is 844-484-5737. Our next caller is from Hawaii, Vance. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Vance.
Hi, Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hi. I have a quick question. So I've been just started reading the Old Testament. I read a lot of the New Testament.
Uh-huh.
I just came to Christ in 2020, so everything is still kind of new to me, but
wow.
Thank you, Lord, for, showing me Christ and for him saving me. I'm the only one in my family right now that's been saved, but anyways, besides the point, so there's one part in the New Testament where it says, Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated, and I just finished Genesis, and when I was reading in Genesis, it showed like a lot of Jacob doing things like taking Esau's birthright and also persuading Isaac that he was Esau to give him the blessings.
Right.
So what is your opinion, or what did they mean when he said that Jacob has I love and Esau has I hated?
All right. That's a good question. The New Testament statement where it says that is Romans 9:13. And there,
yes.
Paul is quoting from Malachi. Chapter 1. Malachi is the last book of the Old Testament. And in Malachi, what God is saying is that he has favored Jacob's family line instead of Esau's family line. He's not actually talking about the man Jacob or the man Esau. Once you get into the Old Testament a little further, and Israel at a later point has become a nation. The nation is sometimes called the name Israel, sometimes called the name Jacob, because they are descended from the man Jacob, who is also called Israel. I don't know if you've gotten as far in Genesis as that point where Jacob's name actually gets changed to Israel. But the nation that came from him, which is the Jewish people, or Israel, they are, throughout the rest of the Bible, they're sometimes called Israel, and they're sometimes called Jacob, because both names were names for the same man. And the nation is considered to be an extension of that man, his progeny. Now, likewise, his brother Esau, who is also called Edom. Remember, Edom means red, and we're told that Esau means hairy. And Esau had two names in his lifetime. One was Esau and one was Edom. Well, his descendants were the Edomites, and sometimes they're called Esau. In other words, it's very common in the Old Testament for a nation to be called by the name of the first person who's like the father of that nation. It's like our, the capital of this country is called Washington, Washington, D.C. Not that Washington is our literal father, but in Old Testament times, Amalek was a man, but his nation was the Amalekites, but sometimes they are simply called Amalek. Gibeon, and the Gibeonites, these are different cases where a group of people are called by the name of their ancestor. Very common practice in Old Testament writing. So in Malachi, where it says, Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated, God is actually talking about the nation of Israel as opposed to the nation of Esau or of the Edomites. And he goes on to explain what he means there. And that is that both Israel and Edom, both nations were taken into captivity by Babylon. Israel was taken in captivity in 586 B.C. Edom was taken into captivity in 583 B.C., 3 years later. And at the end of that captivity, God brought back and restored the nation of Israel. But he didn't bring back and restore the Edomites. That is, God restored the nation of Israel, but did not restore the nation of Edom or Esau. Now, this is when Malachi is writing. Malachi is writing after this has already happened. And he says, listen, I loved Jacob and I hated Esau. I mean, my behavior toward Jacob was obviously positive and loving behavior in restoring that nation from captivity. I didn't do the same thing for the Edomites, is what he's saying. And instead, their hills are still lay waste, and they haven't been restored. So what is being said there is that God favored one nation over another nation, and it was predicted that he would, because Paul says there in Romans 9, even when the two men were in the womb, God said to their mothers, they were twins in the womb, and they were kind of in conflict with each other in the womb, and God spoke to the mother and said, two nations are in your womb, two peoples, meaning ethnic groups, will be separated from between your feet, and one should be greater than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. The older would be Esau and Jacob the younger, but the nation, there were nations, the nation of Esau would serve the nation of Jacob. So even though it talks about these two men, it's referring to them in terms of the nations that came from them and what God would do with the two nations. And that's what many people misunderstand. When he says, Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated, it doesn't mean that Jacob was a good guy. You're right. Reading the story of Jacob, he was a scoundrel. In fact, we don't ever read that Esau was a scoundrel, although he wasn't perfect either. He tried to get the blessing once he had already sold it away. But, I mean, both those boys had flaws. But God had made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he would do something special with the nation that would come from them. And it's the favor he showed on that nation that he's referring to when he says, I have loved Jacob. That means I've loved the nation of Israel. That's what he's actually saying. So that would
that actually helps a lot.
Okay. Well, Vance, I appreciate your call. God bless you. Nigel from Edmonds, Washington, has come back. And are you there with us this time, Nigel?
I hope so. Can you hear me?
Yes, you
please?
Are. Yes, I couldn't hear you before. Okay. It was silent before. Go ahead.
Well, good to talk to you. I did meet you with my daughter back when you went to Monroe, a church in Monroe that you
uh-huh.
spoke at a few months back.
All right.
So I have met you before. And my question is this. It's pretty simple. I know that you talk about the sinner's prayer that is not found in the Bible. But given that a person has come to understand what becoming a Christian involves, in leading them in a prayer, what would you suggest an appropriate wording for a person who is ready to follow Christ?
Okay, well, let me just make clear my position. I'm not against sinners' prayers. What I'm cautioning against is the idea that people get saved by saying a sinner's prayer. In the Bible, no Christian is ever recorded as having been saved by saying a sinner's prayer. They were saved by becoming disciples. Now, a person can say a sinner's prayer, and it can mean nothing to them. I know this because in my upbringing, almost all the kids in our church said a sinner's prayer at some point, and many of them never walked with God in years later. They obviously were not becoming followers of Jesus. They were just saying a sinner's prayer. And it's not saying a sinner's prayer. The Bible never suggests that saying a sinner's prayer would save anyone. It doesn't recommend a sinner's prayer. It doesn't describe anyone doing that as a Christian, becoming a Christian. But what people did was Jesus said, follow me, and they followed him. That's how people became Christians, by becoming followers of Jesus. Now, of course, we're not in a fishing boat with nets and seeing Jesus on the shore saying, come follow us, where we can just jump out of the boat and walk with him like that. And therefore, today, when someone wants to make the transition from having not followed Christ to now being a follower of Christ, it is not uncommon for that transition to be punctuated by a prayer. It doesn't necessarily have to be punctuated by a prayer, but generally speaking, confession of sins is a part of conversion. I mean, repentance is, and repentance is often accompanied by confession. So one could argue that a person should confess their sins to God. This would be something of a prayer. Although, again, just doing that in itself doesn't mean a person has become a follower of Christ. They're saying they are becoming a follower of Christ. That's the thing. Many times we pray things that we don't mean, and not because we're hypocrites, but because we don't even know what the words mean we're using. And so we're not really making the kind of commitment that issues forth in a new life just because someone has told us what words to say in a prayer. So, a person should, you said, what if a person understands what they're doing? Okay, so in other words, they're understanding that they have been a part of the world's system. They're born into it and under bondage to it. And now they are transferring their loyalty from Satan and self, which is kind of the same thing. If you're loyal to yourself, Satan's got you under, you're under his control. And they're denying themselves and taking up their cross and following Jesus. They're actually becoming a loyalist to Jesus. They're entering a battle which exists between two kingdoms. There's the kingdom of the world and there's the kingdom of Christ. And they're joining Christ in his campaign, in his kingdom. He's going to be their king now. If that's what they understand, then I would say that they can pray anything that reflects that. And or even if they don't, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know how they would go very far in this direction without saying some kind of a prayer. But it's not the prayer that saves. It's the changed heart. It's the turning.
Right.
It, that saves. So, but any prayer that reflects the sincere turning to God and becoming a committed follower of Christ would be quite adequate, I think.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for that clarification. And I wish you a great Christmas.
Well, the same to you, Nigel, and your daughter. God bless you both.
Yep. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Ken from Napa, California. Ken, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Well, yes. Good afternoon and Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you.
I appreciated your explanation of Jephthah a while ago because I've been wrestling with that for a long time, and I thought you gave a very good description of how that whole thing came down about Jephthah and his daughter. So I appreciate that. I wanted to ask you one other thing. You were talking the other day on the subject of eternal punishment in hell, and I recall that when I was about 19 years old, I was down in Long Beach to a bookstore down there that had old out-of-print books, and I came up with a book called The Truth About Hell. And in this book, they had translated the time that hell was, of course, the term Sheol was used in the Old Testament 67 times, and in the New Testament 13 times. Mm-hmm. And they went through every one of those interpretations to show how it was used in each in every set of circumstances. And the end result was in certain places where when Jesus Christ went down into Sheol, they put it one way, as when, in other terms, other more violent people went down into Sheol, they put it another way. And the end result of the whole explanation that they had was that a lot of the objective of teaching hell being eternal punishment, that a lot of it had been twisted by the people who interpreted the Bible through the years. So I just wondered if you had any awareness of this or what you had to say about it.
Well, yeah, I wrote a whole book about the three views of hell, and I do have a chapter that deals with the Hebrew and Greek words. Sheol is the Old Testament word that usually is translated, in the older translations, translated hell. But actually, it's very clear, as you point out, it means something else. Sheol actually just means the place of the dead, not necessarily the evil dead, the good dead, too. Just all the dead people, where they go is Sheol, according to the Old Testament Hebrew. In the New Testament, the word Sheol doesn't appear, but the translation of it is Hades, and that appears about 13 times in the New Testament. And it's equivalent to Sheol. So neither of those were, and yet the King James often translated Hades as hell. But neither of those words really mean hell if we're thinking of hell as the place of eternal torment of the lost, because neither Hades nor Sheol are represented in the Bible as places of eternal torment for the lost, simply the place where dead people go, good and bad, and await the judgment. Now, there's other words, though. There's the word Gehenna, which is often thought to be a reference to the lake of fire. I think most people assume this. I'm not convinced that that's what it means, but I think most translations, all translations I know, translate Gehenna as hell. And if any word deserves to be translated as hell, perhaps that one does. and it occurs, I think, about 11 times, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 12. And then there's the word Tartarus, and that appears one time in 2 Peter. But that's just said to be the place where the fallen angels go. And it's not eternal. It's where they go awaiting their judgment. As human souls go to Hades awaiting judgment, the angels who fell go to Tartarus awaiting judgment. And that judgment, many people would associate with the word Gehenna, which appears several times in the New Testament and is translated as hell also. All right. We're going to then talk to Glenda from Eugene, Oregon. Glenda, welcome.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
So I have a question about I've been doing a lot of reading of the Old Testament, and, you know, I get into all these lists of names, and I don't know, you know, I don't know how to pronounce them, for one thing. And I don't know the value of just, there's got to be some purpose that I don't understand. What's the purpose of listing? There's got to be some reason for it. I mean,
The purpose of those lists of names, these are genealogies. In most cases, you're talking about genealogies. There's other places where it's talking about groups of people and gives names of people, too. Some of them not always easy for us to pronounce. But, the most notorious challenges come from reading those lists of genealogies, especially not only in Genesis 5, but in Genesis 10, or 11, excuse me. But also in First Chronicles, the first nine chapters are largely just lists of names and genealogies. What's the purpose of them? Well, obviously, some people in ancient times wanted to be able to trace their ancestry, and they considered their ancestry to be important. In some cases, it was. For example, if they were priests, they'd have to be able to show that their ancestry goes back to Aaron, or if they were, if they were Levites, they'd have to show that they were Levites by their ancestry and so forth. Jesus' ancestry is given, for example, in Matthew chapter 1, in order to prove that he came down through the royal line of David and Mary's. Well, I should say another genealogy is given in Luke chapter 3, which is that of Jesus. And I believe it's that of Mary, though not everyone would agree with that. And that shows that he's descended from David. In other words, connections to important people of the past to whom God made special promises about their offspring are pretty significant. In other words, obviously the genealogy of Jesus going back to Abraham in Matthew is very important because Abraham is the one that God made promises to his seed, and this proves that Jesus is the seed of Abraham. So the reason for the names is because that's the names of the people in the genealogy. Now, if genealogies aren't very important to us, that doesn't mean they weren't to other cultures or that they shouldn't be. But, they definitely evaluated them differently than we did. So that'd be the answer. A lot of people today actually go to Ancestry.com or 23andMe to find out who their ancestors were. I'm not as interested in that as some people are, but obviously we can see there are people who have that interest. And so the Jews had that interest too, and that's why in their books they kept these genealogical records. All right, let's talk to Ray from Sacramento. Ray, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I was just curious whether you believe in pre-trib or post-trib, when would the marriage supper of the Lamb be?
Well, I don't believe in pre-trib. I believe that the Bible everywhere says that the rapture will occur at the resurrection, and that occurs at the second coming of Christ, which Jesus said would be on the last day. So I believe, as the Bible actually fairly plainly teaches, that the rapture and the resurrection will occur on the last day. Now, the last day cannot be 7 years earlier than the last day, for example, or 3.5 years earlier than the last day. So, obviously, the last day is the day after which no other days follow. And So that's when Jesus said he's going to raise his people up. And nothing in the Bible contradicts that at all or gives a different time. The idea that there's a pre-tribulation rapture is something that became popular less than 200 years ago in a system called dispensationalism. But the church didn't teach that, generally speaking, at all for the first 1,800 years. When is the marriage supper of the Lamb? Well, it depends on how you understand it, but I believe the marriage supper of the Lamb is the joining of the bride and the groom is when Jesus comes back. So when Jesus comes back, he's going to join himself with the bride. That's how I understand it.
Okay. So that would be when, in Revelations, where he comes with the armies of heaven, so to speak?
Well, you're talking about Revelation 19, and yeah, if that is a picture of the second coming of Christ, yeah, that would be when the wedding is. But I'm not sure if that vision is talking about the second coming or not. There are different ways of looking at Revelation, and I don't have time to survey them all right now. But yeah, whenever Jesus comes back in his glory with all the saints, that's when I would suggest that the marriage supper of the Lamb takes place.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a plausible answer, I guess. I've been working on this for most of the year, and it goes back
to
a long ways and a lot of theories. So.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Bye now. Elliot from Dallas, Texas. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Well,
I got a question for you. At my young age, when I started studying scriptures, I swore that I read in the Bible somewhere that it is better for a man to drop his seed in the belly of a whore than to drop it on the ground.
No, that's a saying that lots of people have quoted. It's not in the Bible. It's one of those sayings like God helps those who help themselves, or cleanliness is next to godliness. Some people think those are in the Bible. They're not. They're often repeated. Some of them come from Benjamin Franklin and Poor Richard's Almanac. But actually, the idea that it's better to cast your seed into the belly of a whore than to spill it on the ground is often used by people who want to justify fornicating and say it's better to fornicate than to masturbate, is what they're saying, you know. And so that's how they're using it. That is not stated in Scripture. It is derived from, however, and wrongly derived from, the story in Genesis about Judah's son. He had three sons, and the first one married a woman, and he was struck dead because he was wicked. And so the next son, according to the custom of the time, married her, and he didn't want her to have seed by him. So he practiced the withdrawal and spilled his seed on the ground. And God was unhappy with that. And he was struck dead. And then next you find that Judah himself is deceived by her and thinks she's a harlot, goes and has sex with her, and no one gets punished for that. So the suggestion is, well, this guy got punished for casting his seed on the ground, but no one got punished for Judah sleeping with the whore. So someone came up with a little saying, which is not in the Bible, that it's better to cast your seed into the belly of a whore than to cast on the ground. And that is not really the lesson of that story, but I can understand how someone who wants to justify, you know, their own sinful behavior might try to find a lesson like that from it. I'm out of time for this show. Thanks for joining us. I hope you all have a good Christmas season with your families. The Narrow Path is listener supported. At the end of the year, we decide which stations to drop and which ones to add. If we do, depends on finances. If you'd like to help us out, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. If you didn't get that, you can go to our website. You can donate from there if you want. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk again.